Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Great to have you along for the show that aims to get you thinking and regularly brings together Christians and non-Christians for discussion and dialogue. And we're going to be doing that today, looking at the recent release of a new film called The Unbelievers. That's all in a moment's time. Just to say that if you want to catch up on the big event of July that was Unbelievable, the Conference 2014, as I've mentioned in the last couple of weeks programming, you can get hold of it on DVD and MP3 CD. We've got a special box set available to purchase to get online. You can do that. You can pre-order it, and it'll be with you in around September by going online to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD. If you're a fan of the program but weren't able to get along to this year's conference, that's a great way to experience the conference from the comfort of your sitting room, or sharing it in your church small group or something like that. Be great to be able to get hold of that resource if you can. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD. Yes, and we've got lots of your commentary as well on the last few weeks of programming. We're going to be hearing some of that coming up later on today's show. And I do hope you enjoy today's show. Let me introduce you to the theme, the guests, and the film.
You're unbelievable.
Today on Unbelievable, we're talking about The Unbelievers. It's a documentary following biologist Richard Dawkins and physicist Lawrence Krauss as they travel the world speaking to a number of sceptical atheist audiences. It certainly paints a picture of science clearly at odds with religion, and we're going to be hearing some clips from the film today, which is out now on DVD, and hearing from its producer, Gus Holweda. He's going to be in conversation today with Graham Veal, who's the author of New Atheism, A Survival Guide, and we heard from Graham a couple of weeks ago on the programme talking about that book and the flying spaghetti monster. But before we meet Gus, who's the producer of this new film, The Unbelievers, let's hear a little bit from the film itself. This is the promotional video that you can find online.
Richard, what's more important in some sense, if you had a choice, which is to explain science or destroy religion?
I think what these two men are doing out there, promoting a scientific worldview, is something of great value.
There's no one whose views are not subject to question.
Science is wonderful. Science is beautiful. Religion is not wonderful. It's not beautiful. It gets in the way.
But some of the stuff you do really upsets some people. Would you prefer that it was
no,
just...
No, I think these are wonderful things. People shouldn't be threatened by science.
I think we follow people who have courage to think about things that we haven't thought about before.
I think it's very important to advance the pro-science view in the modern world. It can only be a good thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, the dynamic duo of science.
Most evolutionary biologists, they don't believe in this crude fundamentalist version of random selection that you propose.
What a disgusting idea. I'm not saying this is the way it is, you better believe it or else.
And that's the point about beliefs. They don't change the facts. Facts, if you're rational, should change your beliefs.
But if you confront a belief they have and show them immediately that they can see for themselves it's crazy, then they remember it.
That's what I get from these guys, the permission to question everything.
But I have a rule, if there's less than five people, we just go for coffee.
There you go. A taster of what you can find on the Unbelievers DVD film, which is now out on a general release here in the UK. You can find it online, certainly. And of course, we'll make sure there are links to it from the Unbelievable webpage today. But we've got joining us today to talk about it, the film's producer, Gus Holweda, who followed Lawrence Krauss and Richard Dawkins, both well-known atheists in their own right, both scientists, of course, around the world as they spoke to various audiences. It's very good of you to join us today. Thank you for being with me on the program, Gus.
Thank you for having me.
It does really sound very exciting from the little promotional clip we heard there of the film. We'll come to sort of some of the content of the film in just a moment. Be interested to first find out from you, though, your background. I'm assuming that you yourself are an atheist as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can call me that. I'm I find a lot of being on the road with this film and meeting a lot of secularists and non-believers, I find a lot of atheists prefer not to call themselves atheist because they don't like to be pigeonholed as any kind of ist. But yeah, I guess that's fair. I mean, I guess I'm one of those who Pascal's Wager might apply to if you read it from the beginning and see that it's addressed to those who are so made that they cannot believe. I never had a big dramatic deconversion event in my life. I was never able to kind of buy into religion. So even though my family was very religious and I was brought up in that environment, it's never been something that's part of my life.
At what point did you come across people like Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss yourself then?
It was, I guess, in my late 20s, which would have been about 10 years ago now. I'm trying to remember. It wasn't the God delusion that first opened me up to Richard's work. I think it was probably the Selfish Gene. But I kind of think of Richard as two people when he writes. He's got the religious and the anti-religious thing that he does, but his science writing is just so beautiful. I mean, it's like reading poetry. He's maybe the best science writer of the generation, and so once I started reading him, it was very easy to kind of follow from his science writing into his anti-religious stuff.
Now, the genesis of the idea of this film then, did you decide you'd like to simply follow them around? Or did you kind of go to them with a proposal, we'd like to make a documentary of you doing a speaking tour?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a long story, but the short version is I actually was able to have dinner with Christopher Hitchens following his debate with William Lane Craig. I think it was back in 2008. And he asked me if I knew who Lawrence Krauss was, because I lived in the same town as Lawrence, and I didn't know him personally at the time, but he told me it would be worth my while to get to know Lawrence. And so I attended one of Lawrence's events at Arizona State University, and it was a gigantic 12-hour science symposium where he brought together all the biggest names in science, like Brian Greene and Neil deGrasse Tyson and Steven Pinker, and Stephen Hawking was meant to be there, but ended up having to call in for health reasons. But it was essentially a giant rock and roll concert. It was kind of like Woodstock, but for science buffs, you know. And it really was kind of eye-opening to see that this 3,000-seat auditorium could be filled to capacity for 12 hours, and that people were just so enthusiastic about science. And I felt, I don't think anyone's ever really captured that before. So that was kind of the impetus. We pitched a little idea to Lawrence, and it just so happened that he and Richard had a book tour coming up, and all the pieces kind of fell into place in a way that one could almost call miraculous, because it was so quick, and we hit the road with them, and we traveled around Sydney and London and Oxford and Melbourne and New York and D.C. It was a great adventure. As an admirer of their work, it was definitely a fanboy dream come true.
Yes, indeed. And it does kind of sound a bit like a rock tour or something like that, you know. Do you think that atheism at some level and these particular figures within the movement almost it does kind of treat some of these people like modern day rock stars almost?
I think to some extent people do, yeah. I mean, the comparisons often made to religious figureheads and are these kind of the popes of atheism, and I think it is somewhat different in that they're not handing down edicts or dictates or any kind of morality calls. I think they're just very good communicators of science. And like I said, I mean, Richard's writing to me is just. It's just inspiring. It's so wonderful to hear about the reality, the magic of reality, as he calls it. It's so inspiring and eye opening. But I do think there is some of that. I think there, as I've heard you talk about before as well, there's been a bit of a backlash, I think, to the kind of figurehead of atheism, if you want to call them that. But I think for the most part that's a minority within the community. I think most people just appreciate their writings for what they are.
Well, look, let's hear from our other guest, and thank you for joining us today, Gus, to talk about the film. Graham Veal joins us as well. Graham was with us not long ago to talk about his new book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide. And this is very much a film charting the book tour and the speaking tour of two of the key figures in the so-called New Atheist movement. So I thought it would be good to get you back, Graham, to interact with this. So you've had a chance to view the film. Do you want to just give us a thumbnail sketch of what you thought of it?
I thought it was a very good film. I enjoyed it. I think it's a very helpful film in that, well, from a teacher's point of view, my background is a teacher of religious education. And as part of the GCSE course, Gus mightn't be used to our education system, people around about 16, you have to look at secular points of view on the existence of God. And there's not very much out there in terms of films that you could show to young people in short, snappy segments with good arguments in it that would get discussion going. So from that point of view, I think every religious education department should be very interested in purchasing a copy. I also think that churches would be very interested in it, or should be very interested in it. I think that it does summarise a lot of the objections that you will meet when you're talking to people about Christianity, and they are short, snappy, the sort of memes that you'll come across on the internet. And I think watching it in, either as a whole film or in short segments, and discussing the sorts of statement that you hear in the film would be very useful. It is also just a well-made film, and there's a very interesting portrait, I think, of Richard Dawkins in particular. Richard Dawkins seems to have become a very powerful speaker. I mean, he was always good, but at times you would be, you could see how he holds an audience's attention. His science writing's wonderful. I mean, I agree with Gus there. Climbing Mount Improbable, The Ancestor's Tale, these are fantastic books. So yes, I mean, there's a very good side to the film. I think what is interesting is the celebrity culture that I think is very evident. You can see it very much in this sort of rock star experience that Gus talks about, and the adulation of the crowd. I mean, at the Reason rally at the end of the film, I mean, the short introduction is, "Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Richard Dawkins," and the crowd goes wild. I think we're facing similar problems in evangelicalism. If you look, for example, at some of the critiques coming through of, say, the Gospel Coalition or groups like that, people are saying we have too many celebrity speakers. And there was an awful lot about this film that reminded me of contemporary evangelical culture. You know, the conferences, some of the language that was used. You have a conversation between Richard and Lawrence Krauss in the car about, you know, science is wonderful and it's beautiful, and when you're in love with science, you want to tell the world, but science is difficult. And you could just take out that word science and put in the word the gospel. You know, the gospel is beautiful, it's wonderful, you want to tell the world about it, but it is difficult. And I just wonder, you know, how much the two cultures feed into each other, and why this language is appealing. We just do seem to have lifted, you know, evangelical culture or something. It's certainly a culture that I recognise, and I do wonder what the reasons for that are.
It's an interesting point. I wonder, Gus, if you want to sort of comment on that, in as much as, I don't know whether the statement Richard Dawkins or Lawrence Krauss have left the building ever happened at any point, but this kind of adulation, and is that a fair kind of description of the way that lots of the movement do view these figures? And is that almost, playing into a kind of almost religious kind of type of feeling?
Well, I will say, I mean, I've heard Richard and Lawrence talk about it, and they themselves are slightly concerned, but I think they're in many ways that people probably wouldn't assume very humble about these kinds of things. They're a little bit concerned about a cult of personality, essentially, making it difficult for the messages that they want to talk about, the science and so on, that it could be lost behind the cult of personality. But I think the difference is, Lawrence has said it many times, we've taken the film around the world, shown it to many audiences, and one question we often get is, what can we do to help bring people to your cause, to the cause of atheism, if you want? And he's very quick to say, we don't want people to be brought to our cause. We're not trying to convert people. We're not trying. We just want people to think for themselves. And I think there's kind of this, I'm not a psychologist, but I think there's this kind of built-in idea that when people lose religion, that it's suddenly replaced with something equal, and that atheism is that thing. And it's hard. I think it's hard for believers to realize, or people who are just coming out of that environment, that it's just different. I mean, once you lose it, it's not as though it gets replaced with something else necessarily. So
let's hear a clip anyway from the film. And just before we do that, to say, if you'd like to get in touch yourself, perhaps you've seen the film, had a chance to see one of these screenings, perhaps you've picked up a copy of it, and now that it's out on DVD, be interested to hear from you what you think, and perhaps you've seen some of the online clips as well. This new film, The Unbelievers, with the starring roles of Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss, travelling the world speaking to atheist and sceptical audiences. What do you make of it? Do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget you can contact me via Twitter and Facebook as well, @UnbelievableJB. If you'd like to follow me, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB is our Facebook page. All of those links and more available, as well as links to today's programme, where you can find out more about what we're talking about today, from the Unbelievable webpage at the new website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Let's hear then, gentlemen, just a part of that discussion. I think you might have sort of alluded to it already there, Graham, in what you were talking about. But this is just a segment from the film in which Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss are talking sort of before or after an event. And this is Lawrence just asking Richard about what he sees as more important, getting rid of religion or promoting science.
Richard, 10 years ago, I asked you the question in the popular writing and speaking that you do, which is, what's more important in some sense, if you had a choice, which is to explain science or destroy religion?
Oh, I think they go together, because destroy religion makes it sound negative.
Yeah.
To me, it's a positive thing. Science is wonderful. Science is beautiful. And religion is not wonderful. It's not beautiful. It gets in the way. There are all sorts of other things wrong with it, but I mostly care about truth, the beauty of truth, the poetry of reality, which is science, and the fact that religion as a scientific explanation, which it is a competing scientific explanation, it's so dull, it's so boring, it's so petty.
It's wrong, too.
And it's also wrong, yes.
Which I think is probably even more...
more important, yeah.
There you go. I wonder, Graham, what do you make of that? Is this a central theme of the film, as far as you're concerned, in what you've seen of it, this idea that religion essentially is competing as an explanation with science?
Yeah, I think that the film is edited in such a way that an argument is set up, and to be brutally frank, it's nonsense. First of all, you're saying that religion is a scientific... religion is a competing scientific theory. Well, that's absolute twaddle. I mean, there's no two ways about this. Historically, you don't have this conflict between science and religion, because Christian theology played an important role in the birth of science. And it's very important to realise we're not just saying that the first scientists happened to be Christian. We're not just saying that the first scientists were motivated to study the world because they believed it was a creation. We're saying that the first early scientists during the scientific revolution were motivated by theological ideas which then shaped the scientific method. Now, to take one very simple example, talking about the laws of nature, talking about the mechanical worldview, which says that the world is a system of parts which can be described using the laws of mathematics. Now, for us, that seems like common sense. At the time, it was radical. I mean, prior to this, there had been attempts to describe the world using mathematics, which just weren't very persuasive, the Ptolemaic system. People like Galileo, people like Kepler, particularly Descartes, I mean, he's the guy who really brings the laws of nature in and says, well, you know, let's look at what God is like and what God can do. They've got these simple parts that God can conceivably do anything with. Again, there's a theological reason for that. The reason is, well, under the old Aristotelian system, everything has a nature and is bound by its nature. That limits God's freedom. So you've got this system where people are saying, listen, if it's the world is a system of parts that can be described using mathematics, That fits the Christian worldview. That's what we would expect to find. And remember, they're coming up with this hypothesis before they've any proof. I mean, it's easy for us to say, well, it's obvious. It wasn't obvious to everybody back then because they hadn't accumulated the proof yet. So theology and science feed into each other. Now, logically, there's a problem with what Dawkins says there, and that is that there is no scientific theory which says you must build your worldview based on science. There's no scientific experiment which has the result only based your worldview on science. So logically, there's a problem there. And if we look at that picture of the world which science operates on, you've got stuff in the universe which is governed by laws. Well, as Christ admits at the end of his book, theism is an option of this book of universe for nothing, because science itself needs these laws and needs this physical stuff. In his book, it's relativistic quantum fields, which are, you know, governed by the laws of quantum mechanics. And you want to ask, where do they come from? Well, science can't provide an answer. And you can say, well, that's just the way it is. Or you can say, well, there's a reason for this. And that can be looked at from the point of view of philosophy or theology. But, you know, to say that science and religion compete is just historically false. It assumes that science explains away Christianity when it comes up with explanations. When the first scientists were Orthodox Christians who were expecting to find these explanations, because they believed in Christian theism.
Well, it'd be interesting to hear your response to that, Gus. I mean, firstly, do you feel that's a fair characterisation of the way that Lawrence Krauss and Richard Dawkins see the competition between science and faith? And have they not done justice to the actual historical facts of the matter when it comes to the way that Christianity sort of, as according to Graham, has birthed the sciences in many ways?
Well, I mean, it may be true that early scientists were motivated by religion, and I'm sure it is, but I mean, to say that there's no conflict is, I mean, it's just ludicrous. I mean, all you have to do is look back at the conversation between Huxley and Wilberforce to see, you know, exactly how long it took evolution to be brought to the mainstream in the face of religious opposition. I mean, looking back on it through the rose-colored glasses of history, it's easy to say, well, yeah, religion was always right there alongside, but I think anyone who looks into that will find easily many examples of the exact opposite being true. And as far as a world view, I mean, well, do Lawrence and Richard believe those things? I mean, I feel like what Graham just said, I mean, completely contradicted what he said to begin with. To say that Lawrence Krauss doesn't have all the answers and therefore we can get these answers from theology and philosophy is exactly making Richard's point that, you know, religion is a competing theory in some ways. And, you know, Lawrence would say, look, we don't know, and that's the goal of science, is to learn. And religion is saying right off the bat, we do know, and here's the answer, it's God. So, I mean, there is an inherent difference between the two. And
I mean, I need to come back on that. First of all, if you come to the theory of evolution, you'll find that people that would be described as Protestant fundamentalists, like B.B. Warfield, were promoting Darwin at a time when some atheists were objecting to it because you could not observe these processes that Darwin was describing. So that's just a caricature. I will suggest a book edited by Ronald Numbers, which is a book, it's very easy to find, it's very cheap. It's written by atheists, Jews, Muslims, Christians. It's a wide variety of views. It's called Galileo Goes to Jail and 23 Other Myths You've Heard About Science and Religion. Galileo Goes to Jail. I mean, but again, I mean, you would need to read wider than that, even just a basic introduction to the history of science and religion or the scientific revolution, John Henry's, for example. There is the tendency here is to look for somebody like, say, Ken Ham or Ray Comfort, and then look at Richard Dawkins and say, well, that's typical of the dialogue between religion and science. That's just a caricature. The dialogue between the two is much richer than that. And again, you get these myths, for example, at the Reason Rally. And I thought this was hilarious. You have Lawrence Krauss saying, you know, in the medieval era, religious dogmatism undid the Greek Enlightenment. And I was thinking, well, what are we talking about there? The church's funding of universities? The fact that people in those universities were free to speculate on whatever they wanted? I mean, this is just mythology.
I mean, is it fair to say then, Gus, that Lawrence Krauss and Richard Dawkins, experts in their fields of biology and physics, but perhaps not the best spokespeople for talking about the history of Christianity and science. You know, should we go to more, as it were, perhaps less biased or at least more learned sources for that kind of information?
Well, I definitely wouldn't make that concession. I mean, Richard is incredibly well-read on this subject. But I would say, I mean, again, though, to say that there's no conflict and that, you know, it's all just a caricature. I mean, I live in the United States, and I can tell you that when we show the film here, we encounter people all the time who, frankly, are taught in their churches that evolution is a lie. I mean, it's just that simple to them. Evolution is a lie propagated by scientists to undermine their religious beliefs. So, you mentioned Ken Ham and Richard Dawkins as figureheads having this conversation, but again, I think they are less concerned with what the figureheads of these movements might be saying as what the general consensus and the popular movement and the forward progress that's happening around these issues.
I'll bring it back to Graham, because I think you make an important point there, which is simply, can you deny that there are some conflicts going on in the 21st century?
But what you're taking is one particular subculture within evangelicalism, which is very, very vocal, and then extrapolating and saying that that's been the relationship between science and Christianity through history, and that logically the two must be in conflict. I mean, let's come back to what was said about Lawrence Krauss saying he doesn't have all the answers. What we're saying here is we're working on the logic, well, if science can't provide an answer, then there is none. Now, that's nonsense. I mean, if you look at literature, if you look at history, if you look at philosophy, there are all sorts of explanations that are not scientific. And all I'm saying is that if somebody looks at the laws of nature and looks at the very specific values in those laws of nature and asks, well, you know, how come there is a universe that's finely tuned for life, or a multiverse which contains life, whichever you prefer, and wants to know, well, why is it like that when it did not have to be? I'm simply saying, well, theism is a reasonable, considered response to that. Now, the second that you say that, yes, I might not agree with you on that, but I can see that it is reasonable to believe that there is a God, or that theism's true, well, then at that stage, this whole thesis of a conflict between science and religion falls apart. And when it does, this celebrity status that Dawkins and Krauss have gets undermined a bit, because they're claiming to offer the answer to the big questions, or specifically they're saying, well, there is no answer to these big questions. Make up your own meaning. That undermines their celebrity status. So they've got a very, very good reason to attack religion. You know, this isn't that these aren't men without bias. No, I mean, I'm not saying I don't have bias, but the idea that only religious people have bias is just flawed.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, and we will come back for more discussion on this. We're going to hear some more clips as well from the film we're discussing on Unbelievable today. The Unbelievers film, a documentary following Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss, two well-known atheists touring the world, speaking to large audiences and suggesting that there is this fundamental a conflict between science and religion, and we have to choose science over religion. Well, we're going to continue to hear about it in the next part of today's programme. My guests today are the film's producer, Gus Holweder, and also Graham Veal, author of New Atheism, A Survival Guide. Do join us again in a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest magazine, 100 Years On, find out how Christians responded when the world went to war. Meet the Baroness facing down dictators and freeing slaves. Ryan Bell talks to us about his experiment living as an atheist for a year. And find out why gaming phenomenon Minecraft has captured the creative spark of both adults and children. Plus news, reviews and all your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. I'm Justin Brierley, and on Unbelievable today we're talking about a new documentary film now available on DVD called The Unbelievers. It actually came out a little while ago. I've got with me its producer, Gus Holweder, also joined by Graham Veal, who's our Christian guest today on the programme, who's watched the film and is critical of some elements of it, as we've heard. We're going to hear some more clips from it as well in just a moment's time. But just to say, speaking of DVDs and CDs and the like, like. Just a reminder that if you weren't able to attend Unbelievable, the conference 2014, this year, it was held about a month ago in central London with a wide variety of excellent speakers, including William Lane Craig, and people like Oz Guinness as well were there. All kinds of topics from atheism to Islam to science, the Bible, the resurrection of Christ, the historicity of Scripture, and much more besides, tackled in a whole day of seminars. All the material now available on DVD and audio CD in a combined box set. You might want to avail yourself of that, and if so, it's simple as pie. Just go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD, and you can find details of how to get hold of it, shipping options to the UK and the US and other places, and even a special offer if you want to take out a subscription to Premier Christianity magazine. You'll actually get the DVD for free. So lots of options there. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable DVD. Okay, we're going to continue this conversation on this new film, The Unbelievers. We've got Gus Holweder, and we'll come to you in a moment, Gus, as we continue this conversation. Let's hear another clip from the film now, though. This is Richard Dawkins himself while addressing one of the audiences during a book tour in America.
Well, there are, what, 535 members of the US Congress, and one has said that he doesn't believe in a supreme being. That's statistically not possible. I mean, a fair number of those members of Congress presumably have had some sort of education. there have got to be a very substantial number of atheistic members of the United States Congress, probably more than a couple of hundred would be my guess, and yet they cannot admit it. So in order to get elected, you have got to lie about your beliefs.
There you go, Richard Dawkins, sort of making a statement about the nature of politics in the USA. Gus, I can imagine whatever the state of play in the USA as regards whether politicians do claim religious belief, even when they perhaps don't have it because of political reasons. Many Christians will feel a bit annoyed at Richard Dawkins saying, you know, in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way, well, if you're in any way educated, then it's more than likely you'll be an atheist sort of thing. He does have a way of kind of, you know, maybe putting things in a way that, as it were, stoke the flames in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, my brother, who's the director of photography on the film, and I like to joke about that because a lot of people in America do think that Richard can be a little harsh, but we just chalk it up to him being a Brit. And we leave it at that. But I mean, but what Richard says there, it goes to what Graham was saying a few minutes ago about this assumption that there's kind of this small but vocal subset of the U.S. that kind of doesn't believe in evolution. Well, a poll a few years ago said it was 50% of citizens in the U.S. I think that was revised recently with a new poll, and I think it's down to like 33% think that evolution is a lie, you know, propagated by scientists to mislead them. But I mean, that's a ridiculous number. I mean, when Richard says what he says about getting elected in this country, I don't know if you're familiar with that much about American politics, but back in, I believe it was the 2008. There was a primary here where all the Republican candidates were on stage, and the questioner asked, "How many of you believe that evolution happened?" And it was something like 2 out of 7 people raised their hand. I mean, it's not by any means a small thing, at least in this country. I mean, I don't know the intricacies of what it's like over there, but here it's a real issue, and that I think that's the main thing he's getting at, and that's why Lawrence is often appearing in public to talk about, you know, school boards trying to remove evolution from the school books, and you know, having public funding removed from these kinds of things. It is a real problem. In America, anyway.
Sure. Well, there you go. Again, Graham, Gus making the point that it is a different situation in the US, and maybe the kind of, you know, sound bites that Dawkins and Krauss come out with are justified in that kind of climate.
Yes, but you don't get school boards trying to take Newtonian mechanics out of the out of the textbook. We are talking about one issue that seems to have particular cultural importance. If you've spent any time educating teenagers, and if you spend any time talking around people at all, I mean, scientific ignorance goes well beyond evolution. And also, a lot of these surveys, I'm very, very skeptical of them. I mean, I've had conversations with people who assume, for example, that if you say evolution happened, you mean unguided evolution happened. Whenever you ask them, well, you know, evolution happened, but it was planned and there's a God and he's responsible for it, that they're perfectly relaxed. And so I would like to know, you would need to look into those surveys in some depth and say, you know, are we saying that 40% of the American population agrees that Ken Ham's right? Now, I'm not saying that there isn't a problem. I think to move the issue back onto politics, just because a minority is small, or a minority's is relatively small, doesn't mean it can't be very well organized, very, very vocal, doesn't mean that it can't get a lot of people to election booths on election day. And I think one thing that I heard on the Reason rally did concern me for atheists, and that's where an atheist had to say, look, we need to make it clear that we are as moral and as patriotic as other religious people. Now, for somebody to have to say that worried me, because my immediate assumption is, why would anybody think that an atheist can't be patriotic? And it does seem to me that there is a problem there that does need to be addressed. I mean, Gus is from a Baptist background, if I've read correctly, and he would know that the Book of James says, look, the devils believe and tremble, so don't think that having the right beliefs in any way makes you a moral person. If there is an assumption in American politics that having Christian belief makes you a more moral, patriotic person, the first people challenging that should be evangelical Christians. And if they're not, then you need to challenge them on their own terms, rather than saying to them, look, there's this fundamental conflict between science and religion, which we have these border skirmishes from time to time, which seem to gather all the attention. So we tend to look at where these skirmishes are, not on the very, very broad agreement and broad coherence between the two. Instead of that, you can come back to evangelicals on their own terms and say, listen, you know, you're saying only elect Christians or people who are vocally or nominally Christian, but your own beliefs say that you shouldn't do that. So, I mean, I can understand the concern. And I wouldn't want my criticisms of the film, of the arguments in the film, in any way to detract from the fact that I think this is a very good and important film. There did seem to be a concern there that I thought, well, that is genuine. If somebody is out there saying atheists can't be good Americans, you've got a problem.
It's interesting that you say that you know, we should approach the evangelicals in America to address that misconception, because you're correct in saying they are the very ones who are saying that we do have that problem. I mean, the reason that was brought up at the Reason rally by Paul Provenza, who's a comic and a friend and a filmmaker here in the U.S., because it was a rally. You know, it was a rally. That's what it was meant to do. It was meant to get people excited. And it is extremely sad that they have to say that. But I want to come back to what you said about guided versus unguided evolution, because there again, you know, it seems to me that religious people are very quick to get offended when anyone like Richard Dawkins or anyone else says, like, science and religion, there's a conflict. There's no reason why they can't coexist. But when you talk about guided versus unguided evolution, I mean, one is just simply a philosophical point of view and the other one is science.
No, Gus, and guiding mountain probable. Dawkins says, while there is no need for evolution to be guided in his view, there is absolutely no difficulty with evolution by natural selection being guided. He's quite clear on that. And he actually says that in the context of Lamarckianism. So, you know, Dawkins admits in writing and spends quite some time arguing for it, that even if there was evidence for guidance, that would not undermine the idea that natural selection is the mechanism.
Well, of course. If there was, but there isn't, and there never will be.
No, but hang on, I'll tell you something else. If you look at the God delusion, and if you look at the ancestor's tale, Richard Dawkins is very clear that simply starting from an Earth-like planet, the odds of ending up with human beings is incredibly improbable. Or if
sure.
you have billions, he says this in the God delusion. If you go to our website, there's plenty of references to it. The odds are very, very improbable. And that's because you have to get over the origin of life. You have to get the first eukaryotic cells consciousness. These are all low probability events. And I mean, Nick Lane, for example, would agree with this. If you look at his book on life ascending, this is fairly common. Now, so
yeah, well, I mean, the universe is gigantic and old.
Yes, okay,
and improbable things happen all the time. That doesn't mean that it couldn't have happened and that it didn't happen.
The problem is here, if you take billions and billions and billions of Earth-like planets, then Richard Dawkins is saying, well, the odds of ending up with intelligent life on all of those is incredibly low. Now, you cannot invent evidence that isn't there to answer the design argument. What you cannot say is there's billions and billions of Earth-like planets out there, which we might discover in the next 20 years, but we haven't discovered yet, and then go on to tell me what life is like on them. You know, very few of them have life, very few of them have, a small fraction have a bacteria, and a smaller fraction have eukaryotic. So, I mean, that's incredible. That's no answer to the idea that evolution, that there's not a design argument from evolution. That doesn't answer that. But even in terms of, and you're not even talking about a design argument here, you're simply saying that evolution could have been guided. You know, it could have been guided, and you're looking at it and going, well, maybe yes, maybe no. That's still compatible with theism. So the idea that there's some sort of fundamental conflict here between evolution and theism, and for example, even Thomas Huxley didn't agree with this, and he was an agnostic. He said that no, I mean, theism is a philosophical doctrine. There's no conflict here. So
right, that's exactly what it is. It's a philosophical doctrine. There's no conflict because it's not an issue. It's not something that scientists sit around talking about, whether or not it was guided or unguided. They test.
Okay,
they
so why test. Is there a conflict then between theism and Christianity? I mean, why is there a conflict, between theism and science? Where's the conflict?
I had a hard time hearing you there. Between theism and science?
Yeah, where's the conflict here? I mean, what we're saying here is if you've got a theistic religion like Christianity, you're saying there's a conflict with science. Now, we're saying that...
Well, I think it was illustrated a bit in what you just said about the improbability of life beginning on this planet. You're making probability arguments as to why... I mean, it's similar to the anthropic principle. I assume you accept that as a good argument for a religion.
Well, all the anthropic principle tells me is that, you know, if there are intelligent beings, then they will observe a world of a certain structure. That does not tell me that does not explain the existence of the structure or of the intelligent beings. Therefore, I mean, the anthropic principle explains nothing.
But it seems to me that you have the probability argument exactly backwards. I mean,
if we find ourselves living. Because this isn't just me talking. This is you know, philosophers of biology, and I mean, I really don't have this argument backwards. You can say it's just a fluke. You can say, well, maybe there are billions and billions of planets out there that would explain it. I'm not offering this as a definitive proof of God. I am simply saying here is evidence that somebody could look at and say, maybe this was guided. That's all I'm saying.
Well, yeah. I mean, anybody can look at anything and say maybe this was guided, but what I'm saying is that if you look at the improbability of life forming on a planet that's been, if you want to call it, fine-tuned for our type of existence, well, that's just kind of a sense, in a way, a cosmic natural selection. You wouldn't expect to find yourself living on a planet where you can't live.
Yes, I've agreed with that, but the question then is, I've agreed with you there, and I've said, yes, if there are intelligent beings, they are going to exist in certain sorts of environments, but that does not explain why those environments exist. It simply tells you what an intelligent, conscious being can expect to observe. That's all. It explains nothing.
Let me just jump in here, gentlemen, just to move the conversation on a bit. Fascinating conversation on whether that there is a conflict or whether a harmony between science and faith. I mean, coming back to the issue at hand of the way that science gets played off against religion and so on, I mean, I almost get the sense from this film that if Dawkins and Krauss are perhaps, you know, the rock star kind of, you know, people up on the stage representing science, could it be fair to say that science has almost in itself become almost religious in the way that many people observe it and speak of it at these kinds of conventions, Gus? Because, as you said, the way you saw people getting excited about science and so on, and the words awe, majesty, you know, and all of those kinds of things that might once have been used of in sort of religious terms tend to get used by atheists very often about science, and obviously pitted against that is the dull, boring pettiness of religion, as Richard Dawkins calls it. So I mean, it's almost as though science has become the new religion to some degree.
Well, a lot of people say that, but I mean, I prefer to think of it as more like when people come to see Richard and Lawrence talk, they're not coming to church. They're not coming to have their beliefs reaffirmed or to have their faith strengthened. They're coming to have a good time. It's more like going to a rock concert. That's what it's like. And nobody would say, well, if you like Radiohead, then you clearly worship them the same way you're worshiping a god. It's just not comparing like with like. But well, I'll leave it at that because I'm sure Graham wants to hop
in. Before we go back to Graham, let's go for another clip, and we'll hear that in a moment's time. Dawkins talking about his hopes for atheism to become the de facto way of thinking about things. Again, though, if you're listening and you'd like to get in touch, can I encourage you to send in an email, maybe? unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we'll hear some of your thoughts in regards to the last few weeks of programming towards the end of today's show as well, and perhaps get some of your thoughts on that interaction that Graham, one of my guests today, had with Rory Fenton on the Flying Spaghetti Monster a couple of weeks ago. But that's the way to get in touch. You can also find us via the Unbelievable webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Today's show is there, links to the Unbelievers film and where you can find more about my guests, especially actually Graham Veal. As we've mentioned, he's blogs and does a lot of writing for the Saints and Skeptics website, so look that up online if you get the chance as well. And of course he's got a new book out, New Atheism, A Survival Guide. But those are the ways to get in contact as well, at UnbelievableJB if you follow on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. All the links available from the webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Okay, let's hear another clip, a final clip from the movie. This is Richard Dawkins, and this is where he's being interviewed and talking about his hopes for what the future may hold for atheism.
My hope for the future of atheism is that it will no longer be necessary. We don't call ourselves a-Thorists and a-Zeusists and a-Leprechaunists because it's not necessary. And my hope is that the day will come when it simply is taken for granted that everybody doesn't believe in Yahweh any more than they believe in Thor and Jupiter. I think there's some indication that the religious lobby is getting increasingly desperate and is increasing the venom and the vitriol with which they fight back. And I think what we may be seeing is the beginning of the death throes. And when you see a wounded animal in its death throes, it tends to lash out.
Okay, Graham Veal, are we seeing the death throes of religion in the world today?
No, as a matter of fact, I think the new atheism of Richard Dawkins is very much a reaction to the fact that religion has not gone away in the way he expected it to, or at least in the way that the secularization thesis expected it to. That idea was that as science and technology advanced, people would see that they did not need God. It seems to have gone that way in Europe, but it hasn't matched up that way in America. And also politically, religion is very important. But also, and this needs to be very, very clear, if you want to look at scientists like Simon Conway Morris, if you want to look at philosophers like Alvin Bentinga, Richard Swinburne, if you want to look at the top levels of the academy, if you want to look at the top researchers into the history of science and Christianity, they are not coming up with these arguments that atheism is obvious, or that atheism is obviously true. Now, they haven't won the argument in the academy by any stretch of the imagination. They're a minority, but they are there. They cannot be shot down. So you have religious theists in the academy who weren't meant to be there, but are actually in many places having a resurgence. You have the political importance of religion, good and bad. There's a lot of bad out there. I certainly would not see myself as a religionist who wants to promote religion and every form of religion, because religion's a bit, you know, for example, the Tonton Macoute and Papabak du Duvalier in Haiti, you do not want to promote that type of religion. You don't want to promote the type of religion which has people flying planes into towers. So religion isn't necessarily a good, but it hasn't gone away. And I think to some extent there's a bit of a panicked reaction in certain quarters as to, well, why is this the case? Why has it not gone away? Why has history not turned out the way we expected it to? So No, I mean, I don't think there would be a market for the new atheism if religion was in its death throes.
Well, in a way, that was Richard Dawkins' hope, that atheism would become a redundant word because everyone would just realise it was the common sense thing. You know, just as he says, you wouldn't talk about being an aleprechaunist because no one has the foggiest notion that such a thing exists in the first place, in a way. What about you then, Gus? Do you think that... Richard Dawkins' hope is a potential reality? Do you think we are heading in the direction of one day where people won't even think in terms of atheism and theism because it just won't be a discussion that's being had, I suppose?
I don't know. I wouldn't dare to predict the future and speculate. But, I mean, I think these things ebb and flow. I mean, I think it is, you know, it seems to me only religious people like to use the new atheism as a label. It seems that, to me... And to others, new atheism is just the same as old atheism, only they're recent, and with the advent of technology and the fact that in many places now atheists can't be put to the sword for having these ideas, that they're just still out there and they haven't been shut down quite as easily. But, you know, these things ebb and flow. I mean, why has it not gone away? I think there are very good reasons to believe that it's part of our evolutionary makeup to expect religious tendencies in people. I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but many people have written about this, and I think it's probably extremely likely that that is the case. I don't think it'll ever go away entirely. I mean, you know, Christopher Hitchens used to say he didn't want it to go away because if
that,
he
that
did...
Was,
if
that was something that leapt to my mind, was that I've seen another documentary film, and it involved a conversation, if I remember it correctly, between...
Yeah. Collision, I think.
Yeah, Collision, exactly. Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, obviously, while he was still with us. And Dawkins asked this same question to Hitchens and said, would you like to see an end to religion eventually? And curiously, Hitchens said, no, I don't think I would, actually. Now,
but, you know, the reason for that is very interesting, because Hitchens was such a fan of the dialectic of you know, the having a conversation and learning from it. And he just felt kind of in an oblique philosophical way, I think, that without someone to argue strongly on the other side, he would never be able to fully expose and understand the other side. And so he, of course, didn't want it to go.
So life is a bit richer for there being the diversity at some level, I suppose. It's an interesting perspective. I mean, what do you make of the overall desire of Dawkins to see religion at some point completely disappear yourself, Graham?
It's actually interesting that, you know, Gus talking there about Christopher Hitchens. I would, to some extent, as an evangelical Christian, I don't want to see, this sounds strange, I wouldn't want to see religious disagreement or atheism disappear entirely either. I suppose my hope would be is that, you know, you can have this disagreement without life and then they'll all get converted on their deathbed. I certainly want to see everybody... Christian, but you know, Luther's point of view, which I think that Christopher Hitchens was saying in a different way, was that sometimes God strikes a hard blow with a crooked stick. And what he was saying was, listen, just because somebody is heretical from your point of view doesn't mean that you cannot engage with their arguments, because without disagreement, without debate, without the sort of energy that is generated by things like reason rallies, we don't get dialogue, we don't get debate, we don't get the discussion moving forward. I think one of the frustrating things for me is seeing the arguments, you know, in history of science, philosophy of science, all philosophy of religion, they're really not getting down into onto the street. They're not getting they're not making their way into the broader community. And it does seem to me that the sort of debates that can carry on between new atheists and evangelicals, you know, it's a good thing. It can be a very constructive process. And I think the film's good for that reason. I think it is a great conversation starter. I would say the film is a superb conversation starter. As I said a couple of weeks ago, I think it's a terrible place to end the conversation. But it is a very good conversation starter. And I think Gosses made a superb film in that way.
Well, I should say thank you, but also, I mean, that was hopefully the point of the film was to essentially make a conversation start. I mean, I what I find interesting is, you know, I agree with you and also with Christopher that, you know, the dialectic, that the conversation is worth having and that it's probably the best way to illuminate these issues. But what I really wonder is, can the discussion ever end? I mean, if evidence, let's say science could prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that there was no God, I don't believe that religious people would stop believing. I mean, would you stop believing if science could prove there was no God?
I mean, I could put the same argument the other way around. If there was a scientific proof, if somebody out there came up with scientific evidence that, let's go for the ultimate nightmare for Richard Dawkins. Let's suppose that somebody comes up with evidence that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago when a great flood laid down all the geological layers. Would I believe that people would start believing in God? Probably not. Because human beings are very, very good at making excuses and creating elaborate systems to evade evidence. And that doesn't mean you can't have rational discussion. I mean, we can try to force people to be honest and to try and put, you know, acknowledge their biases. I don't think we can get rid of them, but you can say, well, listen, this is where your bias is coming from. But
well, we'll leave it there for the moment, gents, just for time's sake. And I heard Gus wanting to come in and with a response as well. And we'll make sure you're able to do that in the next section, Gus. But yes, we're always starting conversations on this programme. But we also have to end them as well, unfortunately. And that's what we'll be aiming to do in the third part of today's programme. I'm Justin Brierley. You're listening to Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio, part of Faith Explored, every Saturday afternoon, talking about the Unbelievers documentary film available now on DVD. With my guests, its producer, Gus Holweder and Graham Veal. Come back in a moment's time as we conclude the conversation. Welcome back, and we're into the final part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, here on Premier Christian Radio, part of Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon. Faith Explored is both something that exists here on Premier Christian Radio, but also exists within the pages of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm the senior editor there, and a lot of the content from Unbelievable is now being turned around in one way or another and represented in the magazine. And if you're interested in picking up the latest edition of the magazine, the August edition, then you'll find that interview I had with Ryan Bell, the former pastor who's having a year as an atheist. That's in the latest edition where I talked to him about that. And we hear a response from Amy Orr Ewing, who's sort of the resident apologist for Premier Christianity magazine. As I mentioned earlier, there is a deal if you want to get hold of the Unbelievable Conference DVD and audio MP3 CD for free. You'll find that's an offer alongside subscribing to the magazine. Do go and check that out. You can find the link from the Unbelievable DVD webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD. Still to come on the last part of today's programme, after we've heard the final bit of our debate between my two guests today, you're going to hear some feedback. Now, why does Michael say your programme has hit a new low? You'll find out why. We'll also be hearing from a couple of other annoyed listeners, but also some pleased ones as well. Next week on the programme, Wayne Grudem joins me. Now, he's been someone I've wanted to have on for a long time. He's a very well-known theologian, very much on the conservative end of the reformed spectrum. But he's got a new book out. It's called The Poverty of Nations. And he proposes that pouring foreign aid money into developing countries to help bring them out of poverty is simply a failed enterprise. And it's unbiblical. Well, he's going to be in conversation with Richard Glover, who's an Australian economist and theologian, and that's going to be a really interesting discussion between them next week on economics, poverty and the Bible. If you're continuing to listen this Saturday afternoon, I'm going to be joined between 4 and 5 for the profile by George Verwer, the founder of Operation Mobilization. What an extraordinary individual. Chance to hear again my interview with him on the profile between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. So lots of good stuff to come both today and next week, but right now let's finish up the conversation we've been having on the Unbelievers movie.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Okay, as we wrap up this conversation about The Unbelievers, a new film which we've been hearing about today from its producer Gus Holweder, charting the world tour of Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss travelling the world speaking to atheist audiences. We've been talking about the science and religion. Are they at conflict? Is that the right way to paint this whole thing in this DVD? And of course some of the cultural aspects of the science faith debate going on in America. Atheism, will it win the day eventually? From your perspective, I know you were wanting to respond to one or two of the things Graham was saying in the last part of the program there, Gus. So tell us, what did you want to say in response?
Well, I don't want to nitpick, but I mean, things like the proof that the flood could have happened or that the Earth was 6,000 years old, those things wouldn't in and of themselves prove that there is a God. But let's say for the sake of argument that proof could exist, because I think you asked me, would an atheist change their mind and believe in God? Well, the answer is yes. Any reasonable, secular-type, science-oriented person, if there was evidence, would in fact believe in God. My concern is that I find that when you ask religious people the corollary question, if science could prove that God did not exist, would you stop believing? And the answer is usually no, I wouldn't. And I think that's the defining line between the two positions.
I don't know what that proof would look like, Gus, but I mean, if you were to come along with me, for example, let's take the resurrection of Jesus. If you were to show me the tomb of Jesus Christ and the bones in it and Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then I would abandon the Christian faith. I don't believe it's going to happen.
Well, that's very refreshing to hear, I must say, because you're the first person I've ever heard say that.
I've actually heard that a lot from Christians. There's a I forget her name, but the blogger on Unequally Yoked. Leo Libresco. I mean, that's where her journey started, because she said to her boyfriend at the time, who was Roman Catholic, "What would cause you to abandon your faith?" And that was his immediate response. C.S. Lewis. This isn't me being theologically unorthodox. This is Paul. this is the Apostle Paul saying this. If he hasn't risen from the dead, faith's in vain.
Well, I feel like I would believe that when I saw it, though, because it seems to me that it seems like the goal of religious apologetics these days is essentially to square as many circles as possible. So, I mean, I feel like it's easy to say that, but if the evidence were presented, I would be very surprised.
I could not go back into your court there, Gus, and I could say, but yes, it's easy for you to say you'd believe in God, but I mean, one thing that human beings are very, very good at is inventing elaborate systems to get out of trouble, and scientists can be extraordinarily stubborn when it comes to giving up or changing their beliefs, and the history of science is full of that, and sometimes it's a good thing. I mean, Galileo, for example, didn't actually have proof that the Earth went round the sun, but he stuck to his guns, and it was good that he did.
Would it be fair to say, Gus, in the interactions you've had with Lawrence and Richard, I guess I'm asking you to take a personal punt on this, but that they would be somewhat in tune with, I think it was Bertrand Russell, who basically said, "I don't want there to be a God," and so they do have it, as it were, a reason maybe to do their very level best to get, as it were, find ways of dismissing.
I can only tell you my view, because I hate putting words in their mouths. But I mean, Christopher described himself as an anti-theist. And Lawrence doesn't like to describe himself that way. I truly believe that if Lawrence were presented with evidence that God existed, he would change his mind in a heartbeat. I have seen him change his mind on things he has spent his entire life working on. And Richard, Richard has this public persona of being this rigid, unmovable mountain. And I truly, from my time with them, believe that both of them would change their mind if evidence was presented. Now, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what that evidence would be.
Exactly. But I think that's the big question. What kind of evidence would constitute such a degree that they would be willing to change their mind over it?
But again, it's a hard question to ask both ways, because the evidence to prove the existence of God is very different than the ebbing away of the evidence for God. You know what I'm saying? I mean, like, people saw evolution initially as a big chunk, explaining so much that we had attributed to God for so long. So, it's reasonable to assume that we will explain the origins of life you know, the first life that will.
It just reminds me, I think, and I'll let Graham come in as we start to close up. But I do remember during those debates last year with William Lane Craig that Lawrence Krauss was involved in, and as I say, there was some disputes over the legitimacy of William Lane Craig's comments around the film at the time that's caused some controversy at the time. But that aside, they had this interesting interaction whereby Lawrence, I think, basically said, well, if I saw, you know, spelt out in the stars, oh, God, I'm really here kind of thing, then maybe that would be enough to make me start to think it might be true kind of thing. and then you have to ask yourself, well, we know from modern science that the nature and order of our universe is far more unlikely and improbable than something, a message being spelt in the stars. And yet he doesn't feel that that is a good evidence for order and design in the universe, as it were, of a maker. So what? Yeah, I guess it is that question. Could there ever be evidence that would be compelling?
I suppose, I think that Lawrence Krauss could explain away the evidence of the message in the stars with the multiverse. I mean, if you have an infinitely large multiverse, it's going to happen somewhere. You can always, you know, now, I'm not saying Lawrence Krauss would do that. I'm saying it's a logical option. I mean, human beings really don't want to give up a belief, especially a belief that hits our deepest motivations. We can be very good at coming up with excuses. I don't know. Gus would have to answer this. He knows Lawrence Krauss. I do find Lawrence Krauss to be a fascinating character whose mind bounces about everywhere. And in the middle of his first debate with William Lane Craig, which was on the idea that, you know, there's no evidence for God, in the question and answer session, he just out of the blue, he says, well, you know, I can't rule the idea out, and it could be possible, and it could explain this, and it could explain that. And then he jumped on to talk about, you know, something else. So I wouldn't take that statement to William Lane Craig terribly seriously. My own impression from reading a couple of Krauss's books and listening to him is that I do think he is, while he can be very aggressive, I think he could change his mind and be aggressive about the completely opposite idea next week. He does seem to have a mind. I'd be interested to see if that impression's correct, but he does seem to be an absolutely fascinating character. I'd love just to sit and listen to him for a couple of hours, talk about anything. I think you'd learn something.
I think there are some easy examples, though, I mean, of what could constitute proof. I mean, the anthropic principle is thrown around a lot as being, you know, like we live in this fine-tuned universe, and so here we are, and look, it's proof of God. I mean, that's a whittled-down version. But, I mean, imagine that argument if the universe was fine-tuned a certain way and we found that we lived here, but we were completely out of tune for that universe. That would be almost certainly undeniable evidence that a miracle has occurred. But I mean, that's the problem with the anthropic principles. With one hand, the religious people want to say, look how finely tuned it is and how specific that this miracle of life is. And then with the other hand, they want to say miracles can happen at any time. So it's just, it's like having your cake and eating it too.
Okay, just a quick response, Graham.
I mean, fine-tuning's, I think this is a mistake about fine-tuning. Fine-tuning is not not just for human life. I mean, without fine-tuning, you have no stars, no galaxies, no structure. I mean, if you want to talk about an ordered and structured universe at all, with any interesting things in it at all, you need a certain amount, a large amount of fine-tuning. And again, what we seem to be saying there is, well, you've got the certain amount of proof that the universe could have been made, or a certain amount of evidence that our universe could have been made with us in mind. But we could have even more proof, and because we don't have that, we're not going to believe. And I think we wouldn't it be even better if we were here structured and out of kilter with the universe? Wouldn't it be even better if there were miracles every day? And at that stage, you've got to say, well, look, you might have the evidence you need to come to, you might not have all the evidence that you want, but in human inquiry, we generally have to go with the evidence that we need to make a reasoned judgment. And I think the evidence is there, certainly, for anybody. I think everybody should be able to settle on this and to be able to say, look, there is enough evidence here for somebody who is a theist, who believes in God or design or some type of purpose beyond the universe, that's reasonable. And once that door's open, then religion becomes reasonable too. I can't see how anybody could really deny that.
Well, we're going to have to draw it to a close here, gents. Thank you very much for joining me on the programme today, Graham. Just want to close things out. Gus, if people get hold of the DVD, what are you hoping that they'll come away with? And are you expecting any Christians to buy this?
You know, it's interesting. We had a giant test screening, and we did flyers and questionnaires, and we asked people how religious they were. And the people who were the most religious in the audience were the most likely to recommend the film to a friend. We found that very fascinating. And the response to the film so far has been just, I mean, from an audience perspective, it's just been universally wonderful. And I hope the movie encourages conversations. I hope that it shows what it's like to be a rock star for science. You know, the movie's meant to be fun. You're right. It's meant to be a rock and roll tour film. It's meant to be a slice of life to show what it's like to be these guys. And I hope people watch it and don't take it too heavily and too seriously, and just have a fun time and see what it's like to be Richard Dawkins on the road, you know, with groupies and crazy fans running around. And I don't know, I hope. But I will say that the DVD has probably as much bonus content as the actual film, including a lot of wonderful interviews with people like Ricky Gervais and Woody Allen and Cormac McCarthy and Ian McEwan. There's probably more material on there than there is in the actual film, as well as a lot of deleted scenes and some behind-the-scenes stuff that we did. So I'd encourage people to check out the
DVD. We didn't even get a chance to talk about Ricky Gervais and others. But anyway, great to talk to you, Gus. Thanks for being with me on the program today. And equally, Graham, thanks for joining in the conversation as well. Thank you very much, guys. Thank you for listening as well. And if you want to get hold of the film, well, just type in the unbelievers online. I'm sure that'll take you to a link, but equally we've got links and more information on my guests from the Unbelievable webpage too, where you can find today's program, subscribe on iTunes, and find other features and interesting bits and pieces besides. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Again, thanks to my guests, and we'll be hearing some of your thoughts in regard to recent programs in just a moment's time as we catch up on some of your feedback.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thanks for everyone who's been getting in touch in the last couple of weeks. And if you want to do that yourself about today's programme, again, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk if you'd like to email me. You can find the links to the Twitter and Facebook account as well, of course, from the new webpage of Unbelievable. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. It's all looking very pretty there now, a lot prettier than the old site did, and you can find all the past episodes and extra features and that kind of thing. And we're going to continue to add to that new webpage as well. But do go and check it out if you haven't had a chance. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. I had an email this week from Peter Boghossian, and regular listeners will know that he came on air to have a debate with Tim McGrew a couple of months ago about the definition of faith, and particularly in his new book, A Manual for Creating Atheists. Lots of people asking, when will there be a rematch between these two outstanding opponents? This summer, not going to happen, I'm afraid. Boghossian said he's just not available, but we're hoping to maybe set something up for the autumn. But the reason he was emailing me was, you remember we had that sort of straw poll on Facebook that I conducted about how Christians and non-Christians define faith. Is it believing something without sufficient evidence? And most of the Christians polled said, no, that's not the way we define faith. And most of the non-Christians polled said, yes, that is the way we should define faith. Boghossian had sent me an email of someone, a student, an atheist student, who'd done a poll among his student peers and found that most of his student peers did believe that faith should be defined as believing something with insufficient evidence. Obviously, the two polls differ because in my case, I was asking specifically for Christians to give their view and non-Christians to give their view, whereas if you dig down, maybe you can get this info. But that poll that Peter Boghossian sent me is just a sort of general view of the students that were polled and so on. But interesting stuff, and it is a subject we will return to, as I say, at some point down the line. I did post the poll, though, that he sent me on the Facebook and Twitter account of Unbelievable. So if you want to check back there, you'll find the links. That's facebook.com/unbelievablejb, or Twitter is @unbelievablejb to find me there and to follow. Okay, let's look at some of your feedback in other respects. I mentioned Michael, who said, your program has hit a new low. Just been listening to the Flying Spaghetti Monster debate. Again, you had three Christians on, one of which, who was much too nice, was supposed to be an atheist. I assume you're speaking there of Rory Fenton, who was our atheist guest on the programme. Yes, he was nice, but he was an atheist. He wasn't a Christian. You obviously feel that if an atheist isn't being mean enough, they sound a bit too Christian or something along those lines, Michael. Anyway, you say what is really disturbing, and it's not just hilariously funny anymore, is the repeated mantra of the new Christian offensive. This comes across from yourself, too, in many programmes. It's like a gang-up on the supposed atheist of, yes, well, where atheism just falls down is this or that is just not convincing, at which point your Christian guest goes on about the historical evidence for Christ's resurrection or the sightings of his ascension into heaven. It's madness. Get this straight. There very well may be a number of questionable assertions made by atheists, but that doesn't make a very old book written by a few dubious blokes thousands of years ago as the only alternative answer. Your guest and yourself emphasise certain caricatures made of Christianity by atheists, and then in the next sentence try to reinvent the criticism into a more altogether serious and profound note by injecting some pseudo-scientific psychobabble about space, time, and what we don't know what's beyond our finite conscious capabilities, etc., and then begin to go on about the historical evidence of the resurrection. So where is the caricatural element of a virgin impregnated by God's spirit to give birth to his half-God, half-human son? Okay, and you continue. And to top this hilarious charade, you quote something said by William Lane Craig as a put-down to an atheist in one of his debates, after which the self-congratulatory clapping of your Christian guest and yourself are audible across the radio waves. You're obviously very displeased, Michael. I don't remember any self-congratulatory clapping when we quoted a sort of a little something that happened between, I think it was William Lane Craig and, another atheist. But anyway, thank you. You finish, I can't read all of your email, but you finish by saying there may have been a few complaints about the debate between the Scottish fella and the American atheist a few months ago. I think you're talking there about David Robertson coming on opposite Matt Dillahunty of the Atheist Experience. And you say, it was at least riveting listening. Too much cosy slippers under the table of late, if you don't mind me saying so. Why not persuade Pat Condell to come on? Well, I did try to persuade Pat Condell, who's a sort of YouTube blogger, an atheist YouTube blogger, to come on several years ago now, and he didn't seem interested, I'll be honest. I think he prefers doing monologues to camera than actually having a discussion on these things. But thank you. Who knows? Maybe he'd change his mind if I got in touch with him. Anyway, yes, Michael disgruntled in terms of recent shows. But thanks to those who have been getting in touch to say they enjoyed that episode between Rory Fenton and Graham Veal of a couple of weeks ago on the Flying Spaghetti Monster. Here's Ruth in Leeds, who says, I don't believe in atheists. They know there's a God. I don't believe in Santa, but I don't feel the need to start a movement about it. They need to look at their insecurities, repent and turn to Christ. And here's a couple of people getting in touch over the episode of a few weeks ago now. This was Guillaume Bignon, the former French atheist turned Christian theologian, and he was in conversation with Wade Paget, who's sort of gone in the opposite direction. Here's a surgeon who says, I wonder what exactly Guillaume Bignon's credentials are to call himself a theologian. What was he studying at uni before his conversion? It's obvious he converted because of a girl, and that he desperately and futilely is trying to give his newly found worldview a veneer of intellectual support. Guillaume showed profound lack of understanding on how probability works, which shows that whatever he was studying, it wasn't maths. He suggests the number of young Frenchmen is irrelevant, but that's ridiculous. If you increase the number of tries, the cumulative probability of at least one hit trend towards one, as the number of tries exceeds the reciprocal of the individual probability. Try saying that fast. In other words, if you have something that is a one in a million chance, but you have a population size of a million, the chance of at least one hit is 63%. But if your population size is 5 million, it's already more than 99%. Okay. Thank you very much. You would like to the statistics on that front to be investigated a bit more. Let's go to Adam, who says, I'm a Christian in Greenville, South Carolina. I found out about your show through Guillaume Bignon's Twitter post a couple of weeks ago and have since spent hours listening to your back catalogue. I think your show set a tone of respectful engagement with non-Christian worldviews that we're called to, and I'd like to thank you for your sweet reasonableness. One thing did slightly disappoint me about your show. I kept hearing you make reference to an episode about a gorilla Christian, and I searched and searched your archives for that episode. I guess I
wanted to hear about a gorilla who crosses himself and plops down into a pew every Sunday, and a debate with some skeptics over whether the ape was really a Christian. Then I realised you were saying grill a Christian. Not as good, but still good. Thank you very much, Adam. Here's a couple of people who have objected to past shows where they feel the moderation hasn't quite been up to its normal standard. This is going back a while, but Dirk says, I watched a rather dated YouTube debate between Daryl Bock and Bart Ehrman that you aired. I wanted to thank you for hosting these debates. It's, in my view, important that contentious issues are open for layman audiences. I do, however, have some concerns. In that particular debate, one party continuously interrupted and spoke over the other party, and that is a real shame, as it prohibits a balanced opportunity, which I believe is your duty to control as a host slash moderator. Now, I'd have to go back a couple of years to remember exactly who was maybe doing more of the speaking in that one. Sorry that you felt like that, Dirk. Still hope that it was a helpful one. I think that was when they discussed the authorship of New Testament letters, wasn't it? Thank you for getting in touch. Here's someone who just goes by the name S. They wanted to talk about another old episode. This was Adnan Rashid and Robert Spencer talking about whether Muhammad existed, and that was a very feisty episode. You say, listen to it. It was pretty disgusting how Rashid constantly attacked Robert's character. Why on earth didn't you moderate this further rather than using the euphemism feisty debate? What sort of character do you have as a Christian to be so weak as to let that sort of character assassination happen after Rashid had clearly been steamrolled by left field, claiming Spencer didn't write his own book, claiming connections between Breivik and Spencer? I've listened to 50 or 60 episodes of your show, but this one was the final straw, and the softball episode with Rob Bell didn't help either. I won't be listening to you anymore, and I'm quite disappointed you're such a weak Christian and don't stand up for your fellow Spencer, you've put, but I think you meant believer. Anyway, sorry, I guess if you're not listening, you won't hear this anyway, S. But sometimes the guests, they just go it for each other, and it's very hard to actually be in the middle. Come and do this and see how you fare. But I know that most people did see that as a rather different sort of an interaction to the usual. I hope it doesn't stop you listening to more programmes. It would be a shame, wouldn't it? But thank you for getting in touch anyway. All right, it's about all we've time for today in terms of your feedback. Thank you for getting in touch. Be great to hear from you about today's programme as well. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Do go to the website for links to my guest today, and of course for links to the Unbelievable DVD and audio MP3 CD as well, which is available for pre-order. But for now, let me tell you what's coming up at the same time next week. You're unbelievable. Wayne Grudem, who's a conservative reformed theologian, comes on the line to talk about a new book he's written on poverty and economics. It's called The Poverty of Nations, and he proposes that foreign aid to developing countries is a failed enterprise, and it's unbiblical. So Richard Glover, who's a theologian and economist from Australia, is going to be in dialogue with him about that. He takes a different view. So we're going to hear another interesting debate, somewhat outside the normal sort of realm that we interact with next week. But I hope you enjoy it. So come back again, same time, same place, 2:30 p.m. here on Premier Christian Radio, or online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. I'll be back in a moment's time with the profile, my guest today, George Verwer.